Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. Since 2009, Heritage Radio Network podcasts have been exploring the wide world of food, beverage, and agriculture. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network since 2009. Learn more about Roberta's at robertaspizza.com.
Welcome to The Grape Nation, your weekly wine journey. Our guest is Byron Bates. We'll talk to Byron about Wild World, natural ferments, and more. We'll taste a blind wine Byron brought in for our weekly wine sip. I'm your host, Sam Ben Ruby. Stay with us for The Grape Nation on the Heritage Radio Network. We bring wine to the people. Texas-born Byron Bates has been part of the New York wine scene for almost 30 years. He's truly one of the champions of natural wines. After bringing in and introducing his restaurant customers to smaller family artisanal producers, he went on to start his own New York-based wine importation company, Goat Boy Selections. To help further promote these and other producers, mostly other producers, Byron founded the Wild World Wine Festival in 2019 with events in New York and Texas. This year, Wild World is in Red Hook, Brooklyn on October 30th, featuring dinners, seminars, panels, a walk around tasting, celebrating natural wines and other fermented beverages. Byron, you're on the stage now. Welcome back to the Grape Nation.
Thank you, Sam. Very good to be here. Thank you for having me.
Now, Byron, we had you on 4 years ago, and the reason we had you on 4 years ago is our friend Jay Strell reached
That's
out
right.
and said, I have a friend, Byron, who's really doing terrific stuff. He's doing this festival. Would you consider talking to him? And after looking at everything, I'm like, Jesus, you know, this plays into exactly, you know, what's cool, what's important to me. And I just want to point out, and I swear to you, this is not rubbing it in your face. Mm-hmm. But to that point, the Grape Nation has been an early supporter of Wild World.
You know,
because when it happened, it's like, let's do it. We've been a supporter of other festivals like Character, Raw mm-hmm. Wine, the Fancy Lalas. You know, and we've also been very supportive of the smaller, natural, family, artisanal, and thoughtful natural wine producers. So it's great to have you back. So let's get started. As I mentioned in the intro to you, you've been at this a long time. We both hate to admit how long we've been doing stuff, but that's the reality.
For sure.
You know, a lot of times I ask my guests to talk about their history and that chronology to where they got. We kind of discussed that last time. What I'm curious about is where and when that time you got interested in natural wines, and I'm going to use the term natural wine for
sure.
lack of anything else.
Sure.
You know, I mentioned earlier smaller producers, family, artisanal, but when you got into natural wine, give me a little background on where and when you got interested in these wines, and somebody had to sort of nudge you towards them, you know, so who was that?
Nobody nudged me towards it. I was in mid-90s, early 90s in the restaurant business, and we would often have wine training. And I remember I liked wine. I was interested in it. But at 22 or so, you don't really know much. It's you think it's this huge subject that's extremely hard to grasp for some reason. And I remember we were tasting Opus One. the sales rep was our manager, and everyone was oohing and aahing, and I thought it was not good. I thought it was closed and oaky. And later, I didn't know why I thought that and everyone liked it, but I didn't just assume, oh, me stupid. I kind of felt I was onto something. And by chance, I went to Paris that summer for the first time as an adult. And
wine related or just other?
Not at that age.
Yeah.
I was always interested in places, and I had the Patricia Wells book, and I don't know if you remember that. It was seminal. She had a chapter on wine bars, and we'd highlight them and check them off and go to all the places. And I don't know what I was expecting, but what I got was working class bars where people would come after work and slam like a chilled Beaujolais. And I was coming from this culture where wine was something that was, I guess you could say, snooty, and it you had to have a score. It had to be a Grand Cru or a Premier Cru to even be worth your time. There's a famous sommelier who I won't mention, who a sales rep told me he went in to show him or her a bottle of wine, and he just looked at him and folded his arms and says, I don't do vin de pays. that would be absurd now for even this person to say that. So there was just this culture where wine was something different back then. You had to get your wine through mailing lists, like the Rocchioli phenomenon, the Jay McInerney wines that he championed.
Is this as a consumer or restaurants?
As a consumer, right. This is the information you're being fed. And it's what you talked about in restaurants. Like, did you see The Spectator? You're 25 and you're like, Spectator, what's that? The Top 100 came out and
right.
So-and-so won. Like, ooh, those must be great. But having drinking wine as working people drink wine and as the French drank wine, I think for me and a lot of people really opened our eyes to like, wow, you can drink wine like it's Michelob Ultra and just goes down that easy.
You're not chilling Opus.
You're not chilling Opus. Right? That would be disgusting.
Yeah.
Maybe better.
Yeah.
So that was the let's call it natch, because I hate the word natty, and natch is even worse. So the irony works for what I want to say.
We both accept that as a working platform.
Well, natural wine, before I move on, many people like to jump on the semantics of, it's not natural. But the word natural wine comes from the French word nature. And the Americans changed it because of our fetishizing things that are natural and making us feel better about ourselves. But it really means nature. And in France, nature means raw or naked. Like you get a yogurt that's nature. And that's where the word started, that it has no definition or legal term, is irrelevant and a boring semantic argument. We know what we mean by natural wine. It's nature. It's naked. It can have sulfur, but not much. Nothing added, nothing taken away. All that stuff, yes.
You know, you liked wine. You had the Opus. You went to France. You
yes.
saw the working class.
Yes.
You know, now we're almost at the point where you came back, and I guess you're starting a life pointing towards an interest in natural wines, right?
Not natural wines yet. They weren't here yet. Well, there was early natural wine, which we call pre-natch, which was the Kermit wines. There were some Sansouf LaPierre that came in. I think Phil Sorel found all these for Kermit in 94. So those were really the first natural wines to come over. But they weren't all Sansouf. And aesthetically, they weren't challenging, even the Sansouf LaPierre. But they were natural. I think when we talk about the start of natural wine, we're talking about maybe Courtois and Dardenne Ribot and some earlier things that kind of went
any of
beyond.
The Beaujolais guys or not?
No, the Beaujolais wines never did that. Do you remember the first, I don't want to use the word funky, but the first Courtois or,
yeah.
or you know, where it's like, oh, what is that flavor?
Yeah, different than Beaujolais.
Different than natural Beaujolais.
Yeah.
And for me, that was Courtois or Darden Rebo. I know it, an early Darden Rebo, maybe 97, Crows Hermitage. I mean, me and many of the early natural wine people remember standing around drinking that, and that was kind of a changing thing. But yeah, we got more and more into them. The word natural wasn't around yet, at least not here. I didn't hear that word until 2000. I was doing a wine list for a place on First Avenue, and a company called Vineyard Expression came by, and Mark Whitmore, and his sales rep, Donald Breckenridge, who still is in the natural wine trade, also a novelist, brought by some Courtois and other natural things. I don't remember. They were really wild, and they made sense with some of the food that we've had, and that it was the East Village. It was more engaging and conversational and exuberant and pure. But it was a challenge.
Was the challenge getting the consumer, the restaurant person, to drink them, like to recommend, and they go, I never heard that, or that doesn't sound great?
Absolutely.
I mean,
but before that, the challenge was personal. I knew, I was like, you know, what is this? Like, is this wine?
This is you.
Yeah. The really wild ones, the Courtois, right. I mean, the door, the one with the teardrop on it, the white was kind of oxidative and not something I'd ever had. But I kept going back to it.
But was there another handful of wines considered to be natural that weren't as funky, or that was really?
Well, we didn't know yet. It was okay. It was Cru Beaujolais, like La Pierre, right, and Foyard, the Gang
Which
of Four.
Was not funky.
Yeah, we it wasn't exactly. So when it all kind of came together when Vineyard Expression, and then soon after that, Jenny and Francois imports. And then soon after that, Dresner, who was before but really became...
What are we talking? Late 90s, or are we into the 2000s already?
Vineyard Expression was late 90s. Okay. 2000s was, I think, 2001 was the first time I saw Jenny.
It's crazy how not that long ago all of this is.
No, it wasn't that long ago. Yeah. And it was very fun, and it was a diverse group that was kind of saying anti-establishment. We kind of hated that Psalm culture that kind of didn't like us either, you know, and didn't accept us. It was snooty and you know, male driven and machismo and just male-splaining everything, and you had to like this and opening just ridiculous wines that were just over oaked and too serious. There was no fun in it. God bless them, you know, many of them were natural wine advocates now, and some of them have started companies selling natural wine. It's just too interesting to ignore.
Right.
It was a struggle early on. I don't want to, you know, I didn't do anything, nothing heroic, but
you carried to the next restaurant, or as years went by, a conviction.
Absolutely.
And a dedication towards, you know, these wines producers and getting them out there.
All of the early people did. I think we knew we were right. It's just that thing that clicked, and we're just like, this is what everyone should be drinking. And if they don't, it's all I want to sell. I can't go back to the other ones.
So, like, can I pull something out of the air? You were at Balthazar many years ago, big boisterous restaurant, you know, interesting place, interesting owner.
Mm-hmm.
You're there championing, I can't say it, the wines. Are people receptive? I mean, I kind of asked you that before. I mean, did McNally let you bring these wines in?
No, not then.
No. So the Balthazar days were not really...
Well, everyone was there.
Right. That's its significance.
That's
sort of the seed of where everyone came from.
So there must have been some magic there. For some reason that happened.
So then everyone kind of flanges off, you know, and starts really driving the mission.
Yeah, I don't remember. I remember us talking about Beaujolais a lot, but and when the Darden Rebo was opened, I remember those moments. But Jonathan Nossiter, who's a semi-champion of natural wine now, his list was very interesting. It was all French, which was, that's what was radical then, that it was an all French list that was heavy on Alsace. But it was
that's
mostly,
even more radical.
That was very radical.
But where's the radicalism that there was no American and Italian
that's
or
right.
mostly Napa
that's
crap
right.
and all that stuff?
That's right. It was
that's
unheard
what people
of.
Were looking at. Those Parker big Napa cabs.
That's
people
right.
were, okay.
I had an owner throw a list at me and said, where's the Farniente? There's got to be Farniente, which was would be an absurd thing to say today.
Yeah. That's funny.
Yeah, so it was radical to have an all-French list then.
So that was Nostrader.
That was Nostrader.
Balls to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Got your attention. Had some influence on you.
Sure. It was Natural Light, Rosenthal, a lot of Skernick. I think there was a little bit of Kermit. A lot of Beaujolais. So there's an aesthetic to Beaujolais to the glue culture that's such a big part of natural wine. That was there. So there were elements, but it wasn't formed yet. I think when Arnaud Erhardt, he opened 360 in the early...
was that out in Brooklyn?
It was in Red Hook.
Red Hook, exactly. Right, which is funky neighborhood then.
Yeah. Which was really interesting, and everyone, you know, he had a great list that went really deep. And was all natural, which to me, that or Bow 111 in the East Village by the two Chris's, Chris Andrews and Chris Johnson, was an early all natural list in the city. And everyone was considered pretty nuts for doing it. I think Arnaud got away with more because it was Red Hook, and you're expected to be a little funky out there,
right.
and you can take risks, and you don't have the Manhattanites or the...
But you kind of sifted that noise out.
I'm sure you got a few people, where's the Farniente?
But I mean,
exactly.
Yeah. But that makes sense. So is that restaurant and that list sort of the beginning of the commitment, you know?
Well, I remember Jorge Riera, who were very good friends. We were very close back then. I had a little restaurant, kind of a punk rock cafe that served food, kind of old school.
And wine?
It was all, we had all 10 Beaujolais crews.
Okay.
I remember he had just come back from Le Dix Bouteilles in 2000, I think this must have been 2002. And he could, you know, his voice fluttered. He was so excited to show me these wines. And I was like, oh, these wines are effed up. But his enthusiasm, you know, intrigued me. And it just took off from there. And we had parties with Terry Puzelot at the restaurant, Olivier Cousin. This was just like, it's like piano. It was basically, we opened the same week as Pianos in
the Lower
East Side.
Were the parties for you, or were you able to get people to come and drink? Little of both.
Little of both. Okay. Yeah. There just wasn't that big of a culture for this then. But we had a lot of passion for it. Then Laurent Sayard came along, and
another notable.
He was a big champion of the wines, and now makes the wines.
Jorge has served me his wines; they're terrific.
Yeah, Jorge just had such passion for these wines, and was such spoke about them with such enthusiasm. It was infectious. And you just wanted to try them. That's what happened to me. And Bill Fitch, who's also works with me importing wines.
So you're open and you're already taking it in. But you meet guys like Jorge, who even you're looking at saying, oh, my God, this guy's like off the charts about this stuff.
Sure.
You know, so that's infectious to you, too.
He took it to the next level. I was already on board with Glue Glue and Beaujolais. And light whites, light reds, not oaked. And he took me to the next step, and I became very enthusiastic about the wines. We, you know, Puzelot, Moss, a lot of the early ones.
So I may be leaving a gap in between, but at some point you're doing this, you know, there's recognition of natural wines more than before. You worked at a handful of restaurants. when and why do you get out of that and start an import company? is it you want to get off the floor, or it's you yes. could be more effective importing than somming?
I got a job as a GM at ISA in Brooklyn, and I did the wine list. I wanted to do, there wasn't much of a budget, so I wanted to do something I hadn't done with natural wine yet. So how do you make a statement with a small list? I decided to do something, which was a little eye-rolling now, but it made sense to me then, which was all sans souf list.
Wow.
And the younglings on the floor and in the kitchen accused me of being, a 40-year-old man that was copying what the kids are doing. Like, oh, natural wine must be cool, so I'm going to do that too. And there was
That must have hurt a little.
It was absurd.
Absurd is the right word, actually.
And it's funny now, I was 39 or 40, just the ageism on the floor I saw. And I wasn't comfortable working the floor in a restaurant anymore. Nothing bad happened. It was just like, it's time to move on.
A culmination and that towards the end. So exactly. That happens and you go, well, what am I going to do? And the logical thing was stay in the business, represent what you believe in.
Well, there was a feeling then that there were too many importers, which is funny now because there's triple the amount of natural wine importers that there was in 2013 when we started.
Too many natural-leaning importers? Or?
Sure, yeah. There's a story where Joe Dresner pulled Zev Rovine aside, which...
Does Joe look at Zev as like a small startup?
Oh, I think the story Zev told me once is Joe told him, it's like, there's no more wines. You should get out of this business early on. Which is kind of tongue in cheek. Joe had that way about him.
That's,
But that was the feeling. And in 2013, people would say, well, there was also the feeling that might be true. In 2013, people were, what are you going to get? There's no more wines out there. But of course there is.
I was going to ask you this question later, and it's, mm-hmm. you don't have to give me a long answer. Are there still wineries that have no representation that need guys like you? I mean, whether you like the wine or not is your call, but you could travel through France and Italy and Eastern Europe and you could still pick up, or everyone's got their hands on someone?
No, you can always find things.
And is there decent stuff out there?
That's harder to find. I mean, we've got a really good team. We have a partner in France that is, as they say, an OG natural wine from the 80s in Paris, who connects us to a lot of people that wouldn't normally export to America or haven't been looked at. But the problem with too many importers now is it seems like such a fun business that people are bringing in wines we would be approached with years ago and just kind of like, oh, these guys again. Like they're never going to get imported. The wine sucks.
Right.
And you're seeing those come in now because there's an upstart of some importers. Some are great. That are starting to bring these in.
Because they need to bring something
in. They need to bring something in.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, I've been to festivals, not sure Wild World, where you talk to people pouring and they have no representation, which is part of the reason they're here.
It seems crazy. And early on...
Maybe in the last couple of years, that's slowed down a little, but that's been the case. It's like, who represents you? There's nobody. That's, you know anybody?
It's difficult. But maybe the wines aren't, certain big books may have too many producers that are similar and they don't want to,
Where they suck.
Or they suck.
All right. So you answered my question on, how natural wine touched you, how you stayed with it, how you ran with it, and how you got to, importing it. So for me, this is a good segue to my next question, which you and I kind of collaborated a little about some of the things we want to talk to. And this is such a big one because, without really asking you, you did define natural wine in your mind. I've lost the audacity to say, Byron, you're an expert. Give me your definition of natural wine. You came out unsolicited. But here's a segue that's interesting to me. The history of natural wine in the U.S., which you talked about a little because kind of you were part of it, but I'm interested in the history as it applies in the U.S. Would you say some of the things we discussed, you know, are important to, you know, the exposure and growth of natural wine? You know, you New York guys, Jorge, Arnard, all those guys.
Yeah, yeah.
But take the history thing to a bigger place, too.
Do I think there we've helped expand natural wine globally?
Or you were part of the early history in the U.S.?
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
So what is the history of the U.S.? Is it fair to say what you discussed is part of it or a start?
Sure. Well, there's, you know, I'm sure I'm leaving some people out. Of course I am. And
don't
apologies
worry
to any
about
of them.
That. You know, I mean, you're not going to get everyone.
Well, it's just become, you know, there was Lou Amdur, who's in Los Angeles, who I know was very early champion of these wines. It was difficult to sell the wines early on. You know, they would re-ferment. The owners of the places you were doing the list for would, I remember protests, like, what's wrong with you? Why is this on the menu? And I stood by it and you know, there's, I remember having Telkel by, it's a Gamay called Le Telkel. I think it's Puzelot? Anyway, a Loire cuvée in 2005, and it's everywhere now. But we poured it by the glass then, and I remember I was like in a corner of the restaurant, like, what have I done? People are like, I can't believe you're selling this.
In a bad way.
In a bad way, yeah.
Did you say it re-fermented or some of the wines re-fermented?
A lot of them did back then. There wasn't what we call mouse now. For some reason.
So re-fermentation.
In the bottle. Yeah.
Whatever the mousy thing or how wide of a, it would get that.
Yeah,
kind
the corks
of,
would be pushed down. There wasn't right. The shipping standards now.
What about appearance? Did it get cloudy or that wasn't?
There was a little
that?
Bit of that, but yeah. not as much as now. Now that's a plus, I think.
Right.
Then it was, there would be a little cleaner. There were certainly cloudy wines, but I think definitely more now.
All right, so stay with the history.
Mm-hmm.
In the U.S., you know, keep what are some of the other things, you know, that were happening that kind of built the foundation, you know, for natural wine? It was.
I mean, not until the teens did it really kind of start to go mainstream. I mean, you had a handful of people, which we've discussed. In the aughts.
Are you talking like 13 or 18?
Like 2010 to 2020 era.
Okay. So that decade was a...
That's when it changed and went expanded.
And what were the things that made it expand? Importers, guys like you that were succeeding in getting it on lists, evangelizing these wines?
Well, I don't know if it was anyone's goal to promote or evangelize them. I think I remember going to like a corporate wine event in the early, like maybe 2011, 2010. And, you know, there's Sonoma Couture. It was a big event, but there were two natural people, I think from the Rhone. And all these people were regular people you'd see at like Aspen Food and Wine, like corporate food and wine lifers. And there was the line for the natural wine producers were exponentially longer. There was a long wait. So whether they wanted to admit it or not and roll their eyes at what was happening, they were curious about it. And it couldn't be ignored any longer. The wines are delicious. They can go to places that conventional wines, commercial wines can't. They're more prone to be flawed because there's no additives or fewer additives and fewer chemicals. But you're going to get...
So you're talking about this wine event in 2011, you said?
Yeah. And
it's
now
2023.
Maybe it was earlier.
Are people more educated, even if those flaws exist, or there's more consistency or both?
Well, there's more consistency. Well, there was more consistency. Now there's so many people are bringing in some of the stuff that's not really good.
Right.
There's an influx of importers now that are bringing in things that aren't good. There's also mainstream commercial books that are bringing in stuff
right.
that's not really interesting.
That's where this stuff goes, though, with any category.
With any category, yeah.
You know? I mean, it's just kind of sad how it gets proliferated by people just wanting to be in that crowd.
Yeah, for sure. So, I think this curiosity came about. I think young people really picked up on it. It's a culture that's inclusive. It's interesting. It's really easy to understand right off. And you're understanding something that you thought you never could. Like wine. Oh, I understand wine. I thought I would never understand this, but I get this. And it's not what I thought it was. It's not this serious Parker 99 wine spectator mystery. It's not my parents' wine.
Right.
And I think kids really expanded this. And the culture of inclusion, the culture of, it's a lot like music, you know, it's what your friends are listening to. In this case, it's what your friends are drinking.
It's a good point.
Yeah, that's where, you know, what are you drinking? It's you don't really learn it.
Or you go to a party and you bring two bottles and you turn people on.
That's right.
Not even the question, it's the serve.
That's right.
Yeah, I mean, that's a big part. Do you think the proliferation of natural wines in the U.S. was on a similar parallel to Europe? Or because everything you said, you know, this demographic and, you know, how the wines came in, is the history in the U.S. totally different then?
The thought process in Paris is different, but the trajectory is exact. There's such huge connections between the scene in Paris and New York. You know, from Four Horsemen to Le Verveillet
right.
to, you know, everyone knows everyone very well. And a lot of us are doing the same thing or are inspired by each other to do similar things.
Is there still a demographic sweet spot? Like for everything that's going on, the majority of the interest is drinking age to 40, less interest over 40. Is it wider? 10 years ago, that 30-year-old has now grown to a 40-year-old? I mean, or is it pretty inclusive?
Is it like
now?
Hippies where when they turn 40, they
Same thing with music too again. Yeah,
yeah with music, yeah. No, there's a lot of middle age and older people that started in their 20s and 30s on this that are very much into this. But yeah, the sweet spot is young people.
Is it fair to say that once people know that generation is big on, you know, background and stories, once they know the story, you know, about these wines, you know, where they came from and how they're farmed, is that as important to them too, other than just the label?
I think the story.
Because we talked about orange wine, just because it's orange wine, it's cool. What is it? I don't know.
Right.
You know, natural wines that, but there's more, and that's the story and the people. Is that what drives people towards the interest along with the product?
Very much so.
Okay.
I think to a fault sometimes. I think sometimes we know too much about our producers. You don't know who makes your vacuum cleaner, so you can't judge them. Sometimes you see a flaw and, you know,
I'd like to meet my vacuum cleaner guy. I'd like to punch him in the head. The battery lasts like 34 minutes. You think it would be longer, right?
These days you think it would.
Yeah. All right, so before we got to take a break in a couple of minutes, and you know, of course, I want to move to Wild World, and you know, you and I could sit here and probably do a season of shows on this topic.
Well, I was there. I'm not the expert, and I don't think there is an expert on this. But
I think you're underselling yourself a little. I think at least by osmosis, you know, you were there.
Yeah.
You know, it gives you some information that wasn't accessible to other people. Let me let me calm you down. You're a mini expert. Okay. Is that fair enough?
I'll take that.
So one of the other things, you know, as you and I were corresponding, is one of the things you said, and make sure I'm on the right track with this, if it applies to what we've been talking about. You mentioned in a very short line, you know, let's talk about the fact that the wine industry is in trouble. Do you remember saying
that? I don't know if, well, I maybe said something as grandiose as that, but I doubt it.
But what were you thinking when you wrote that? Because all the other things you said were okay.
Well, I think, you know, the natural wine world itself is in a little bit of trouble because, well, many factors. One is climate change.
I want you to address that, but lead me into that, you know, the other trouble things.
There's many people importing things that aren't good right now.
Right.
There's markets have disappeared, like the rosé market is suddenly gone, and people are closing out wines right now and flooding the market with closeouts. And
so
we're not purchasing.
Clarify that a little. You have all these importers, they have inventory. They don't want to be stuck with it, so they're going in the market and flooding the market.
Exactly.
Which kind of pushes you aside because, hey, Byron, thanks, but I can get this stuff.
It pushes, and if it's pushing me or us aside, it's pushing the winemaker aside too.
Right.
Like we can't
buy
right now.
Well, that's the reality.
Because, that's the reality.
Yeah.
Like any business.
Right.
But I just wish people knew that. You know, I wish sommeliers or wine directors would, you know, I understand the pricing. I've done this my whole adult life, but when a wine is $24 and a Budweiser or a cocktail is still $14, like you're just sending the wrong message. You're hiding all of your costs in wine. And these wines, people have experience with them where they're not to their taste. They're flawed and they're told they're not flawed by an inexperienced sommelier. They're not exciting because they're selling an $8 bottle for $24. So I think people are shy to order wine on a wine list. And I don't want to, say anything bad about my friends that are sommeliers because some of them work in very expensive restaurants and it's justified. But I'm talking about where a cocktail is $14, you need a wine that costs that price too.
Right.
Otherwise, people aren't going to buy it.
Yeah, I mean, logically, you need to compete. You need to make it compelling. You need to make it a consideration.
Exactly.
You blow it right out of the water, you know, with an $8, $10 differential.
And when it's a risk.
Right.
You know,
right.
Conventional wine knows, you know, right. that Opus One at $30, they know what they're getting.
It's not Meiomi Pinot Noir.
No, it's not. Exactly.
Right. Anything else before I want you to talk about climate change? So they're flooding the market. What else? What are some of the other troubles that you
have? A lot of misinformation.
In what form?
A lack of curiosity and excitement from some sommeliers or programs. I think people need to do more research and work, digging up wines maybe people have never had that they're excited by, instead of digging up $8 bottles that are on closeout that no one is excited by anymore.
Has there been a shift in the somm world that prompts you to say that, or that vibe has been going on? Because a lot of people you and I know, you work with, you know, people that are friends left the floor, you know, and they're doing similar things, importation or, you know, whatever. Is that because those guys were better at it and the new people aren't, or that's always been the mindset, or there was always a sector that had that mindset?
I mean, that was always how this was dismissed, like the sommeliers. I mean, we get it too. Like, I'll send a wine back and like, well, maybe you don't like natural wine. Have you had it? And it just like, you just take it and like, okay, whatever.
Right.
But I think, you know, your average customer comes into a restaurant to order a glass of wine and maybe the sommelier is young, which doesn't mean anything, but maybe they're inexperienced too.
Right.
Or their enthusiasm is misguided. It's in one spot. Because they visited this one vineyard and the magic dust was sprinkled on them and they're in
one country.
Yeah. And even that's fine, but I think it's I wish we weren't all selling the, I get this a lot from my friends. You know, we see the same wines at a lot of the same places. There's not many people digging deeper. There's not many good record stores with that killer import section. It's like, where did you find this? I've never seen this. It's like, oh my
records,
God, you've got
you
Ganavet.
Have to dig more.
Yeah, no,
wine,
it's,
you know.
No, it's, oh my God, you've got Ganavet. This is going to kill, which is great. But I'm more, personally, I want you to show me something I've never seen.
Right.
I
that's
just kind of do.
Kind of safe in that, you know, genre. But is access to these wines? I know, you know, I talked to Justin Cherno or whatever. He goes, you see that? I get three bottles now. I used to get cases or whatever. Is access,
well, access
to
is
you
a problem.
And then
yes,
you
yes,
to the
yes.
restaurant?
And that's why you need to dig
available?
For other stuff. Yes.
Right. But that's the, you know, even, you know, Justin will admit, so I couldn't get that. I found this.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
That's inquisitive. Other people are like, I couldn't get that. I'm screwed. So access, because so many people are interested and the allotments just continue to shrink.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that was early on when I did a list that was mostly natural. I would get, you know, Manhattanites come in and go, I don't know any of these wines. Like, you're not supposed to. Like, right. Like
it's like, okay, you okay. feel like you validated the subject.
Yeah, exactly.
It's
like,
silly.
Again, where's the farniente?
Yeah, it's a good point. Let's close out on, and this is not a subject, you know, that should be rushed, but, you know, you don't have to spend forever on it. And that's the affectations of climate change in the world you and I are talking about, you know, which is, you know, natural producers in that sense. You know, we have a concern about climate change. To people that practice thoughtfully, is it different for them? Is it harder for them? Is it because they're smaller, they don't have money, there's more on the line?
It's all those things. And I don't want to pretend to be an expert on this, but what I've seen and been told, first of all, if you want to talk about climate change as a controversy, you won't get that from natural winemakers. It's just a given. It's a shrug, like 100%. Of course there's climate change, because they're all seeing drastically different picking times.
Right.
They're seeing more hail. They're seeing, which is maybe the worst.
Later bud or earlier
pick. Exactly. Or frost.
Frost, right.
So some producers have, they're doing co-ferments. They're making wines with other people. There's a Loire producer that was buying Merlot from a Roussillon producer and vinifying it in Chinon and selling it. And that's commonplace now. Maybe less natural sometimes than it used to be, because they need to make a living and can't afford to lose what they do have. And I think as consumers and dogmatic natural wine buyers, we need to be more patient and understanding of that. It's a commodity. It's a product we enjoy. And if they need to make a living, sometimes, you know, a little sulfur is not the boogeyman. You know, they're just trying to make a living. They're doing the best they can. If they're making a wine with another producer in another region, that might not make sense. If the wines don't reflect terroir, that's fine too. Which, what I mean is, if they are buying grapes from somewhere else or doing something that wouldn't typically taste like their region, sometimes it's okay. Some of them aren't affected, but, you know, there was a rash of suicides.
Because of all of these?
Because
changes?
Of all this.
Wow.
Yeah. Well, I don't know that, but I'm sure that's a factor.
Right. Very stressful.
It's very stressful. And I think we just need, they deserve our support and an open mind. And what they're getting a lot of times is over-criticized for many things, for political reasons, for practices, you know. I just feel like we need to support them more. And
does it seem like they're subjected to more scrutiny, or not necessary.
Well, I can't say anyone's been unfairly scrutinized. The ones that have been scrutinized have been fairly scrutinized,
right.
And they need to be called out. That's you know, fairness and equity is what something we all understand and strive for. It's nothing new. Yeah, I just think, especially in the practices in the winery, I think we need to be more open-minded to some of the, I don't want to call them shortcuts, but some of the techniques and some of the things
you're
doing to survive.
It's okay.
Yeah.
And don't forget, we're talking under the light of climate change, that these are things that you may have to think about doing.
Sure.
You're kind of forced.
Sure.
You know, so when you say shortcut, that's the negative. But the reality is, because of that, you know, maybe you have to pivot. So are these...
Exactly.
Would you say these winemakers, and again, natural, small, family, or whatever, they're better and more likely to pivot to do these things?
Well, they have to pivot, yeah.
Well, they don't have to. I'm sure some Napa cab guy is going to, you know, milk the climate change thing, planting.
Well, they're not going to go conventional. They're not going to.
No, I don't mean that way. I mean, you know, start planting other things, co-fermenting, you know, that type.
I've
seen maybe
some
Malbec
of that.
Grows better in Napa and you need to blend that in.
Right.
Or, you know.
Right.
But the smaller, the natural guys are more likely to make the pivot because they have to.
Well, yeah, they're risking more. They're not right. using the chemicals to guarantee a product.
Right. So I think we're really at the, the effects of climate change we've been talking about for years, but I think it just, you know, it gets more difficult. I mean, each season sort of brings another challenge. So,
yeah.
I mean, I'd love to talk about that again. Byron, we got to take a quick break. Like I said, these are some pretty heavy discussions. So
I'm not sure I'm the right one for
that.
No,
that's not my point. My
I can
point
only tell
is
you
if,
what I've
if
seen.
We didn't get to everything, you know, if you didn't, I mean, it's okay. We'll get to it at some point. We're going to take a quick break. We're talking to Byron Bates. Byron is the founder, creator of the Wild World Festivals, Goat Boy Selections, Wine Importation. When we come back, I want to talk to Byron about the upcoming Wild World Natural Wine and Fermentation Festival coming to New York. You're listening to The Grape Nation on the Heritage Radio Network. We'll be right back.
This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network. Roberta's was founded in Bushwick in 2008 and has become one of the most iconic restaurants in the country. HRN made its home inside of Roberta's in 2009, and together they have become part of the DIY fabric of the neighborhood. Roberta's is open for lunch and dinner 7 days a week and serves much more than just the famous wood-fired pizzas. Their team dreams up new salads, pastas, and sandwiches on the regular. Roberta's Tiki Bar is alive and well in the back garden, serving up frozen drinks in the summer and hot toddies in the winter. Stop by the bakery and takeout spot next door for fresh breads, sticky buns, and pizzas to go. But Roberta's also extends beyond Bushwick, with multiple locations in New York City, Long Island, and Los Angeles. You can also find their frozen pies in grocery stores around the country. The spirit of Roberta's, like Heritage Radio Network, is everywhere. Here's to many more years of pizza-powered radio. Learn more about Roberta's at robertaspizza.com.
All right, we're back. We're back with my guest, Byron Bates. I know I mentioned Byron Bates once at the end of the first half. I should promote him more. Maybe I'll do that. All right. So, Wild World Natural Wine and Fermentation Festival is coming to New York at the end of the month. You and I are sitting here in early October. The Wild World, what is the official name of it? I see Wild World. I see Wild World Festival. I see Wild World Wine Festival. And for me, what do we call it from here on in? Wild World.
Wild World. Wild okay. World Fermentation Festival.
Okay. Wild World Fermentation Festival. So this October 30th, and one of the reasons I actually wanted you on last week, Byron, but you were at your dad's birthday, to give time to talk about this and maybe sell some tickets and, you know, anything else. October 30th at Strong Rope Brewery in Red Hook, Brooklyn. It's kind of a cool spot. It's right near the water or on the water, right? I remember going to past ones, and it was indoor mostly. Is this one mostly outdoor or...?
No, it's indoors.
It is indoor. Okay. You could grab a bite and walk outside or eat, drink and all of that. All right. So you and I discussed this off air. Talk to me about the festival, the mechanics. Let's talk about, you know, when is it?
Well, the basics is it's October 30th from 12 to 6:30.
Okay.
50 plus producers of... all different types of wild fermented products. It's mostly natural wine, but with ciders, meads, and some foods. There's a soju, there's some kombucha, and our snack bar is going to be curated and run by Emile Desmet, from a great young chef from Le Chateaubriand in Paris. And
that's pretty hot stuff.
He's creating a stinky cheeseburger, which is the ground lamb with epoisse, amongst many other things. So if you come for anything, come for that.
Talk about going off the recipe a little. Curiosity. You said you have 50 plus producers. How do you curate and select these guys?
We don't vet them. They just have to fit certain parameters.
But do you reach out? Do they reach out to you?
Both.
Do you?
Both. Okay. We have a website, wildworldfestival.com, where they can sign up. But we only want the wine producers to wild ferment. The reason being...
Can you just quickly tell people, if they're scratching their head, what a wild fermentation is?
It's just an open fermentation with indigenous wild yeasts that are present there.
Right. No addition.
It's not inoculated with a chemical or a factory-produced yeast, which most wines are. The beers don't have to be wild fermented. They have to be craft, which there's not a technical term for that, but we all know what it means. The meads and ciders have to be wild fermented. When I say we don't vet, I just mean we want to be open to produce. I don't want a thumbs up or thumbs down the quality of something, because the idea is to improve and to share information. So some of these people maybe could improve if they're around other producers and colleagues. They can share information. We're a science-based festival that's structured around the producers and their dialogue and their needs. But it happens to be open to the public, and we sell tickets so you can come and find out.
So you're serving the producer in your mind by saying not vetting. If that guy can come, meet people, learn, it's a great...
If they're going for this style of wild fermented natural wines, yes, they can come.
Right.
I don't think I should say... you know, the wines suck, get out of here. Because they want to come because they want to improve them. Having said that, you know, nothing really sucks. You know,
yeah,
they're
sure
on the right track. And
trust me, I'm sure. stay with the mechanics with me for a second. We're talking about Strong Rope Brewery, a walk around tasting, you know, with 50 wine, mead, cider, and all that. In addition, that's part of this festival. Talk to me about panel discussion seminars, you know, you're doing a dinner, you know, which further extends the reach, you know, of all of this.
Right. Well, we call ourselves a science-based festival, which means we want to dispel myths. We're an open-minded inquiry forum. And there's we felt there was a really gap there. That it was mostly a celebration at other festivals and a place to sell wine, not to
be challenging or controversial. So the panel discussions...
Did it evolve to that, or you always had
it
that
started
notion?
With that. Yeah, it started with that.
It did. Okay.
What has evolved this year, and what makes this one more exciting to me, is we're doing the panels the night before, and it's just for the producers.
Not open to the public.
There's a few tickets to the public, which are being released now. There's 100 seats total. I think the producers look at like 70 of them.
I'm going to ask you again, but where would somebody go website-wise? Because maybe they'll jump on the computer now.
Wildworldfestival.com.
Okay.
It's $150 for the dinner. It's based on the King Midas Feast, which if you've read Dr. Patrick McGovern's book, Ancient Fermentation, him and Sam from Dogfish Head. He's an anthropologist. He's considered the Indiana Jones of fermented beverages. And he's our guest speaker, along with panels with Alice Firing, Garrett Oliver, and many others. We'll do a panel on co-ferments, a panel on ancient fermentation. And then the dinner is going to be prepared by Gabby Guglielmetti, who used to work up in Hudson at a very famous place called Monfilio Bakery, which many will know. And he'll be doing the dinner there. And it goes from 6 to 10, all the wines included. You'll be privy to ask questions for the panels.
It sounds like a very thoughtful, well thought out event. And I also like the way you differentiate. Listen, there's a lot of festivals around the world in New York, how you differentiate, you know, what this is versus others. And they all have their own, you know, shtick or whatever. Not shtick.
It's a shtick, sure.
They all have their own goals or
this
whatever.
Is my shtick.
Now, you said myths that you were trying to dispel by way of the festival.
Correct.
You know, give me the Casey Kasem top five, you know, myths that we need to dispel.
The insistence that natural wine doesn't give you a headache is one. That's
BS.
That's anecdotal.
Okay.
That's not real science.
Because people say, oh, there's no sulfur in it.
You get headaches from having too much. Well, some people get headaches from having too much ethanol, which is really... The culprit here.
That's
low
glad
amounts
you mentioned
of sulfites
that.
I just want the science on that, and we want to hear the science. I'm not a teacher, and I build this festival around people teaching me or teaching us and answering the questions we might have. I don't need to hear someone say it doesn't give you a headache. Drink up. It's better for the environment. Drink up. Tell me why, and tell me why. The flavor is like this. Tell me, let's talk about the aesthetics and the politics, the ethics of these products. That is just good for the environment because it's less bad than conventional wine. It's not good for the environment. It's just, like I said, less bad than conventional wine.
So we're picking words, but it's important. People think this is good for the environment. There's nothing... good or bad, good. It's just not as bad
it's
as
not
the
as
other
bad.
Practitioners.
It's less bad.
Less bad. That was your term. That's fair and that's honest.
It's honest, and I just think there needs to be a forum that checks that sort of BS and that anecdotal evidence, and that it's really pointless. And it was people were running rampant with it. We were seeing panels and people discussing as if it were fact some of these ideas, and it seemed to be taking over the discussions about natural wine and fermentation. It's this, and no one
was one of those myths. You know, it's cloudy, it's mousy, it's inconsistent, or that's just part of it.
Well, some are. I think there's a myth in the general public that
presentation is seen as not a right wine.
Exactly.
Right.
And it may not be
the way it is. You're thinking otherwise.
Well, it may not be to your taste, but one of the arguments I wanted there's this Tech Somm thing, the first one in Austin we did. It's like I wanted them to come, and these people that are in the press saying, announcing they don't like natural wine, I said, I can do a festival where it's impossible for them to say they don't like these wines. They're beautiful, or whatever beauty is. They're not flawed in the way they think they are. Natural wine is not a flavor profile. There is, it tastes like natural wine.
People think that. Yeah.
They think it is. It can be. There's a bigger spectrum of flavors, and a lot of them cradle what we consider flawed or.
But why is that? I mean, is that an education thing? I mean, that's a crazy point to me that's, you could dispel that, which is what we're talking about. But why do people still think that? I mean, it's just because this is in its infancy and, you know, things need to be worked out or understood or...
Maybe some disgust for the culture around it and the explainism that a lot of us are guilty of. But natural wine it's just more varied in texture, and we wanted to show that. It's more varied in aromas and flavors, and the spectrum of flavors is much greater. Conventional wines are they're cosmetically enhanced. It's like, I guess, cosmetic surgery. If you have work on your face done, they can all sort of look similar. And the limited features of a wine or a human face that humans can be conscious of liking are similar to each other. So conventional wines can start, or manipulated wines can start looking very similar. And the beauty or the wabi-sabi can be in the one that kind of cradles, that dances with flawed, that gets closer to the sun.
Right.
That's where real beauty comes from. I'm not dogmatic about sulfites. Wines are very bad, but I can say the most...
Because of no sulfites, they're bad?
I can say the best wines I've ever had were without sulfur. But
can you
most,
name one or two?
I don't remember.
Okay.
But
French?
But they can just be just extraordinary and perfect. But they take real risk doing that.
Still?
It's really lucky to... Oh, sure.
Years and years later.
Sure, sure.
Is the risk like shipping it, you know, temperature changes, putting it on a boat or a plane, or it goes way before that?
Sure, it can get matterized easier.
That's part of it. Yeah, also 3 days after it's fermented.
Bacterial or re-ferment. Many things can go wrong. Chance is open to more degrees of chaos. And you'll get that with Notch wine. It's a risk, but it's not boring. And life shouldn't be boring, should it?
No, true that. And, you know, if you know, you know. If you don't, you need to try.
That's right.
You know.
Should I open this now?
Yeah. Let me ask you about this. You know, we've been talking about wines. Good luck opening that. We had to get five.
I'm going to blind taste you on this, but.
Okay. You know, we talked about. You know, a little about farming, certainly what you do in the cellar, what the philosophy is. What we haven't talked about is the people and the culture. Now, part of the culture we talked about is how people perceive, you know, natural wines and all that. Mm-hmm. But there's also a culture of the winemakers and the community. And that's as much about, like, people... You know, ethics, mm-hmm. people working and all of that. I mean, is that more present in natural wine, natural winemakers? I would think so, right?
It's
part of the overall culture.
It's a big part of the overall culture. I think sometimes we go too far and ask too much of the producers and expect, you put them on a pedestal a lot of times.
Now we do.
And that can be dangerous.
First, they put chefs on a pedestal. Yeah. They were rock stars. Then a lot of Somms sort of made their way. Social media helped all of that.
You know what happens.
Restaurants were the original.
You know what happens when you're on a pedestal?
Fall off.
Yeah, you can fall off. Yeah.
I agree with all of that. Then winemakers. You know, these guys, you know, they were put on pedestals. And, you know, everybody kind of bowed to them.
Yeah.
Which is interesting. So there's definitely a different and better culture. All right. So you're pouring a wine. In a few minutes, we're going to get more in depth, you know, about the wines. But you want me to see if I could figure out what this is?
It's not that hard.
It smells like a cider. But what do I know? I have to spit today. Wow, is that good?
You like that?
I'm thinking pear.
Pear cider?
Pear co-ferment?
Wow. It's, you don't have to spit because it's kombucha. N-A.
So I could say it at Raw Wine. I did the guys from New York. I did kombucha. And I didn't commit the taste enough to memory. And I remember walking away.
Of course.
That
well, 10 years ago, I...
But know, this is... People think of kombucha, you buy in a bodega, there's four of them across.
Exactly.
This is
exactly.
Like artisanally made to the next level.
See the bottle? It's they,
wait, is there no alcohol in here?
No alcohol. It's presented as a wine. I had this at Folgerant's, and they blind tasted it with one of the courses, and we all thought Pet Nat.
Yeah, I would say Pet Nat.
Yeah.
I would say Pet Nat, or I said cider first, because there's a teeny bit of fruitiness to it that I find here more than in a Pet Nat.
It's a little, yeah, it's not as deceptive as another cuvée I had of this, but it's from Unified Ferments, which...
Those are the guys I spoke to?
Yeah, yeah.
Aren't they in town or in Brooklyn or
they're
something?
In Brooklyn.
Yeah.
They're
two guys.
Near the Navy Yard in Clinton Hill. Two guys, old friends. And the goal is to approach the complexity and depth of wine while honoring the tea. And this is an oolong from central Taiwan.
I remember they were using tea.
Wensheng.
That's what I'm getting. I'm getting the... that. Yeah. You know, as a little kid, you'd drink Chinese tea and you'd have this distinctive sort of like aftertaste. This is it in a good way.
It has the aesthetics of a fermented alcoholic beverage. And that's kind of why I had this represent Wild World, is that was kind of the through line with the beers we were choosing. And the wines and the ciders, there's more in common with these craft products, these fermented products, I think, with natural wine than natural wine has with conventional wine, which is a bigger chasm to me.
Right.
Aesthetically, there's a through line with lambic beers, kombucha made like this, ciders
What's
made
lambic,
like...
What's lambic, the introduction of fruits or other flavorings?
Lambic or cool ship, a wild fermented beer like what Cantillon does.
If you can only get it now.
Exactly.
So lambic is the style?
Yes.
Okay. This is the dumbest, most uninformed question I'm going to ask you. Can you make alcoholic kombucha?
Yes.
I mean,
I think it's very low.
Right. So you wouldn't do it to make it close to a Pet Nat. That's not what you're...
No. I think you're talking maybe 2% tops.
Yeah.
And I'm guessing. We talked a little bit about this with Young from Unified Ferments. And he did want to point out that it's non-alcoholic.
So this is a great alternative to people that can't really drink alcohol.
I think so.
And
or drink a lot of alcohol and need to drink a little less.
That, you
that's
know,
what, that's
it on,
what
and
cider's
it's
been doing.
It's complex. It's interesting. It's delicious.
I remember, do you remember that pomegranate drink, Pom?
Yeah, sure.
I had a friend.
Tasted nothing like pomegranate.
No. But I had a friend that used to drink that when she wanted to try to drink less or whatever, like drink less sober January. And she said Pom gave her that sensation. Of
it's
red wine,
antioxidant, and
yeah, there's tannins
it has the
a little bit,
mouth
yeah.
feel and all. Yeah, it's also
and
about 180 calories.
Yeah, exactly,
she didn't realize it. That's funny. So this is the United Ferment. Unified Ferment.
Unified Ferments in Brooklyn.
In Brooklyn,
it's always wine bottles.
Right.
It's not the kombucha in the shop.
Right.
And they're blowing up. They're doing such good work.
Are you? Do you rep these guys? No, you said you didn't. I'm sorry I brought that up. All right.
Just a fan.
As a last topic, and you know, we promised not to spend a lot of time. Congratulations on Goat Boy. I guess you've been doing it about a decade, right?
Oh my goodness!
You started it, like you said, in 13. It's 23 this year. At some point, you hit that 10-year mark, right? So,
sort of a 10-year mark. For the first six, we were
didn't know what you were doing. No.
That's the last six. The first six, we were with a large importer. Import company.
So independent after that six.
We were like a segment of their book. They bought the wines and did all the logistics. But that was always the deal. We and it was birthed out of presenting to a larger importer. They need natural wine and we're the people that can do it.
Interesting.
And now they're doing well with natural wines.
All right. I'm curious who it is, but I'm not going to ask you. Who cares? So it's funny what you just said. You went in one way and you've come out another way. You know, I was going to ask you what your intentions are. I guess intentions or plans change. When you started it, we talked about how you segued from restaurant to importer. Was the intention obvious? I just want to drink these wines that I believe in and bring these guys in and champion them?
This has been vaguely, yes, but more recently, starting with COVID and then the Trump tax on wines, which was devastating, and then this last summer, which was equally devastating in its own way.
The death of rosé.
When we had invested heavily in rosé. Right. But we want to, and I say we, me and my partner Bill, Bill Fitch, we want to do something. It sounds so simple-minded and corny, but let's just focus on wines we really like and buy those. Let's not try to like, oh, we need a Prosecco because we got to make money. We need this because we got to make money. I think there's so much noise out there that if people can just look at the back label, if they have a wine shop they like, then they know who to turn to turn them onto new wines. If they go to a wine shop when they don't know who's in there, they can turn the ball around and see, you know, Zev Rovine selections or LDM, which is Dresdner, Jenny and Francois, maybe Goat Boy. And each of the importers kind of have their own aesthetic tastes, their own style. And we want to develop that style. We want to be, I've always seen us as like a sommelier's friend. Like, unfortunately, there's not a lot of really curious sommeliers out there. But if I were a sommelier, I'm like, nobody has that. You have very little of it. I want it all. Like, boom. The import section.
Not enough of that. And you said something that I preach, and my guests do exactly what you do. If you know wine, you kind of know what to do, where to go. If you don't know, there are two things you could do, and that's be inquisitive to the right people at the right place. If you know there's a cool local wine store, I mean, they're there to curate good stuff and turn you on. So you ask them. You say, hey, I like a light red wine or blah, blah, blah.
Absolutely.
So talking to people is one thing, and you could apply that to sommeliers too, but you know, we've talked about the flaws of sommeliers. And really the other thing is you guys go through so much pain, you know, business-wise and philosophically to bring in all these great winemakers. You turn the back of a wine bottle and you know you're going to find a certain type of wine from Goat Boy, from Kermit Lynch, you know, from Jenny and Francois. We just solved everyone's problem in a way.
Sure.
You know, I but you have to look and you have to ask, you know, which is important. And I think, you know, it's kind of as simple as that, you know. So, you know, I was going to ask you and you answered it. I mean, the importance of a wine importer, you know, is sort of underrated because these are the guys giving you the options.
We're the conduit between the producer and the wholesaler.
Right.
And the sommelier is the conduit between the customer and the producer.
And like you said, you have a philosophy. You pick the wines you like. You're not bringing a Prosecco in because you need it in the lineup.
The books that fail have no philosophy.
People who go to your, you know, portfolio, if they love it, they stick with it. If they don't, there's other options.
Sure.
You know, not the end of the world.
So. And you're not going to like everything. We would be, to me, that would be boring.
I agree with
that. But you're going to be challenged or intrigued or...
So many, many more years to go, boy. And hopefully
thank you.
Life gets easier. And listen, I don't have to tell you what to do in life, but I'm going to tell you order less rosé next year.
That sounds like sound advice.
Please listen to me. All right. So we went backwards. We Byron brought in a kombucha, which we talked about. The unified kombucha made from oolong tea. And I didn't mention this, but I post, you know, everything. I'm going to post what we tasted for our wine sip. I'm going to ask you quickly to answer my wine list. Five questions. I asked you. I asked you these same five questions, you know, 4 years ago, and I'll do a comparison. So the first question is, what are you drinking now? And that is in the context of what are you curious about? What's in your fridge? What are you keep drinking, you know, over and over? You know, the season changes may change that.
Sure.
And just a few things. What are you?
Well, right now, anything tied into a wild world.
Okay, so your focus is related.
A lot of cider, a lot of local cider, a lot of craft beers, lambic beers.
More of that than even wine itself?
No.
Okay.
But equal to it. Kombuchas that are interesting, and there are a lot of interesting kombuchas now.
Yes.
Words I never thought I would say.
Yeah, which is pretty cool.
But keep an open mind, right?
Yeah, you know, and hopefully more people get into it and do it the right way. So what you're drinking now is a variety of things that particularly relate to the festival, which is wild ferments of wine, beer, mead, kombucha. Good answer. A lot of times I say, well, give me some specifics. I think if you look at the lineup at Wild World, there's your answer.
Right.
You know, it's any of those guys. All right. I think I may have gotten caught on this, and I asked you before because it's the goofiest effing question. And the question is your favorite wine and food pairing.
Well, I told you I wasn't.
I thought 5-7 years ago this was a cool question. The last 4 years, I prefaced it by saying this is the nerdiest question, but I'm not about to take it off. So, you know, you've tasted a lot of wines. You have been in the food business. I'm not asking you what you think the best wine and food pairing is. I'm asking what you like.
What I like? I told you I wasn't going to say something corny or cute.
Right.
But I'm going to get cute with the answer.
Okay. I'll be the judge of that.
I lied. Okay. It doesn't get any cornier than this.
Come on. Let's go.
Loire Cabernet Franc with fall leaves and a scarf.
I don't know what to do, punch you or throw you out. But punching is very violent, so let me rid myself in the room of that thought. And it would be interruptive to throw you out. Okay, we got the fun answer out. Now give me a friggin' answer, will you? Is it Pinot Noir and chicken? I mean, what is it?
No, it's Cabernet Franc with
fall leaves.
Like a Chinon, a rustic Chinon, like Marula or Lenoir.
With?
Well, any fall dish, you know.
Okay.
Roasted vegetables.
Right, we move stew, into that heartier. Okay.
But there is something about Cabernet Franc that awed me about it.
So when you answer that question, your love of Cabernet Franc and how you think about it triggers you to start the answer with Cabernet Franc, and then what goes with it?
I mean, Cabernet Franc is the most difficult grape to enjoy. It seems to only be good when it's organic and in the Loire Valley. And even then, it's like 5%.
Yeah, you're right about that.
But when it's spectacular, man.
You're right.
Chenin, the same. Only Loire.
Yes.
For me.
And you know what? It's not one of the wines that a million people are making, but they're making it everywhere. And
right.
To your point, you know, you got to go back to the source. All right. I hope you can answer this, because when I ask it, I don't want you to feel like you have to rank it, or if you exclude anyone, you screwed them. But the question is your favorite wine restaurant and or bar. And the question is, who are the good practitioners of food and wine, or just a wine bar? And this is a Byron question. It's not like, you know, well, these guys are the best. It's where do you go that you're comfortable, or the vibe is good, or the list, you know, impresses you?
Well, you know, I like surprises. And so I've listed some places that continually surprise me. And are the import sections of wine these days. My favorite is there's a in Montmartre in Paris. It's called Rock Bottles, and it's an English expat named Oliver Gage. And you go in there, it's just, you don't know anything. He does
it's a retail or a wine?
Retail.
Okay.
It's wines you've never heard of. And he goes deep. He does his work. He studies. Goes
like
to every
no one
salon
else?
Like no one else.
Wow.
Highly recommend that.
I don't think anybody's ever mentioned that guy. Give me something else like that.
For an interesting list in Barcelona, I love Monochrome. In Texas, there's Light
Monochrome's
Years.
Monochrome's the name of the restaurant?
Restaurant, yeah. In Texas, there's...
You don't hear people talk about Monochrome when you hear a Barcelona.
Great little list in a great little square.
See,
solid
this is
food.
What I'm looking for.
Yeah.
All right, Texas.
Go to Light Years in Houston and Lolo in Austin. Great list, passionate proprietors, always a surprise, always fun. There's a new bar, and I just went to New Orleans fairly recently. It's called the Tell Me Bar.
Oh, that's
have you heard of?
That's what's his name?
Corey. Yeah.
They're getting a lot of recognition. I guess COVID delayed the opening, and they got going. It's like the coolest bar in
the
country,
certainly in
New Orleans. Yeah.
One more I want to shout out to for this summer. I went to spend some time in France. There's a bar in a town called Sète, which is out. It's a coastal town, a rust industrial kind of sea town known for its oysters. And there's a natural wine bar there called Cave Vin Vivant in Sète.
Sète is S-E-T?
S-E-T-E.
T-E, okay. What's the closest?
Montpellier.
Okay.
But everyone is around there. Matassa, La Sorga, Peyras, so many producers are within that region. But what I love about it, and what I love about the natural wine bar scene, is you go to a place like this, you find it on Raisin or word of mouth, and you go to this spot, and it's a culture there and a community of, I guess, natural wine lovers, if that's a thing. And, you know, the whole trip was set after that. They told you where to go. Well, we don't go there for oysters. I know a spot.
Wow.
Someone nudges
them.
So you shouldn't
like
be telling them about this spot. Like,
right.
Yeah, amazing. And that's kind of what I look for. Choose the wines for me. Tell me where to go.
That's me too.
Yeah.
It's in your hands.
It's in your hands, exactly.
I know shit.
Exactly.
You know,
I mess it up every time.
Especially when I'm totally out of an element.
Totally.
You know. All right, those are good ones. And like I said, I'm going to post those. And that's why I do this thing, because it disseminates great information that only, you know, guys like you will, you know, come across and touch. All right, fourth question. And let me set this up for you before you jump into it. Favorite all-time wine? In the old days when I started the show, you know, I would like to ask Aldo some, you know, what's your favorite all-time wine? And I was leaning towards, you know, Aldo, you're exposed to everything. What was the most expensive, you know, rare wine? I don't care about that. The question now is favorite all-time wine in the context of what is that wine to Byron Bates that was an awakening wine, a gateway wine, you know, an influencer wine that changed the way you thought. And it may not be one. It could be a few. Maybe you can't answer it.
No,
maybe it's like,
well, it's the wine.
Maybe it's like leaves in a scarf.
A wine. Yeah, that's my answer again.
Okay. We're doing that
ditto,
again.
Ditto. One of the most seminal wines, which I think back on a lot, it's defunct now, but it's Domaine de Peyre. 2004.
Can you spell for me so I know what?
Domaine de P-E-Y-R-A.
P-E-Y-R-A. Okay.
It was in the Auvergne. It was a
is all Gamay. Stefan Majoun and Emmanuel Chavassieu. And it was when natural wine had started. So 2004, 2005, this came along. It was like $80, $90 a carton, a case wholesale. We were pouring it by the glass. Everyone sort of had it, and it became a phenomenon. And then it just is gone.
What region did you say it was from?
Auvergne. It's Auvergne. Volcanic, Gamay and volcanic soil. Those were great.
When did they stop making wine?
2007, I think.
Is there any of it around?
I had it in Copenhagen 5 years ago, and the waitress, she's like, "Oh, you want the Pera? Okay, let's do it." So you know, it's 5 minutes open. Poof, it's gone. So we're like, we got it. Like it's light. It's volcanic soil. It's Gamay. Like, well, there's five of us. We'll get through it in five minutes.
Pour it. We'll drink it.
There was a little bit of magic left in it, and you
did
still
you capture
could,
it. You got it in the glass.
Yeah, it's still there.
Was it ridiculously priced or not necessarily?
No, not really. Saturn used to have some late in there in Paris. I think they're closed now, but they had some. You see it a few places now. And the other was Brendyshev, Minu Pinot by Claude Tubup, Thierry Pouzelat, and his brother. It was a grape I'd never heard of.
When did you drink that?
2004 or 5.
Okay. So these were the early shaping.
Oh, man. It was like Montrachet. It was beautiful.
But these wines, I'm asking you, stood out. I mean, that's why you're recalling them. I mean, I'm sure you had other ones, but these are notables.
That was the turn. Those were seminal for sure.
Those are good ones. And like I said, post those. All right. Last question. And, you know, a lot of times I put people on the spot and say, if you can't answer this one properly, then who can? And the question is, recommend to me the best wines around 15, 20, $22.
Easy.
I need a red and a white. The redundant setup is my kids are in their late 20s, early 30s. They can't bring a shitty $11 supermarket wine to a dinner as a gift. But they also are not spending $45. So how do you wow and ooh at $19, $23, you know, what are you bringing? You could do region, you know, Muscadet, whatever, or you could do makers, both, whatever. So give me recommend a red and a white to me.
Okay.
Keep the price range in mind.
The price range is in mind. White. Okay. Roditas from Peloponnese.
Wait, Roditas is the maker?
It's the grape.
The grape, R-O-D-I-T-I-S. Roditas. And
it's what Retsina is made with.
Okay.
It's from a producer called Tetramythos.
Spell T-E. Tetramythos. Is this Greek?
It's Greek, yes.
Okay, Tetramythos. All right, I'll figure everything out.
A full disclosure, it's a goat boy wine.
Okay, so, yeah, I'm fine with that.
But it's great value. It hits that mark of $15. Also, the Retsina he does, fantastic Retsina.
Are these like good food wines?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Oh, yes.
All right, so I'm
It's Roditas Nature. So it's also sans souffle.
Okay.
Beautiful, inexpensive, all you need.
You get everything you want at the price. I'm pretty comfortable saying I don't think anyone's ever recommended that wine on the show.
No,
we've done an almost 300 wine list. Nobody put that. All right, so that's my white. What's my red?
Red, a little more difficult.
Red is more difficult.
In
the price.
Under around 15 retail?
You can go 20, 22, 23 bucks. Retail.
Okay. I will go with a.
I don't know if it's 22.
It's close.
I don't care.
I'm sorry, folks. I'm under pressure.
No, you don't have to apologize. I'm letting you out. I'm happy to talk about Goat Boy wine.
Thank you.
Because of the reason why that you procure these, winemakers, and they're just in a list of good winemakers. So who's the red?
Let's go with Louis Maur, M A U E R.
Okay.
Young winemaker in Alsace, and his Pinot Noir.
which is on the inexpensive side. I think it would be about 20, 22 wholesale. It's got that rusticity of you recognize from like a Frick or Binet Alsatian Pinot, a little softer, but great food wine, great That's wine on its one. Own. Yeah, it's delicious.
Is
it's really good.
Characteristic of Alsatian Pinots?
It is, but a little softer.
Okay. Like I said, I'm going to post all of those. I mean, we didn't go quick, but, you know, there's a lot of new names and all that. So, you know, I do a social media post with the wine list. So everybody will, you know, what was Byron talking about? What's that white wine? You'll all have access to the postings. I thank you for that. You did an admirable job on that with some exciting new wines. All right, Byron, we got to wrap up. Byron said to me, he goes, we're doing the interview, what's it going to be, about 35 minutes? I just want you to know we're
well,
at
you know,
the
it flew
one
by, right?
We're at the 1.5 hour mark almost. All right, Byron, let me do a quick wrap up, and I need some info from you to help our listeners. So if you have a question, suggestion, wine happening, or event, hit me up at sam@thegrapenation.com. That's sam@thegrapenation.com. As always, subscribe to the Grape Nation podcast on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, Google Podcasts, or wherever you get your pods. If you like the show, leave a good review. And also, like I said, subscribe. You can follow us on Instagram at SBenRuby and on Twitter at BenRuby, which are two different things, but you can always get us at the hashtag TheGrapeNation. We're at Facebook at TheGrapeNation. As I mentioned, we will post Byron's wine list, those five questions, all the great specific answers. I'll post those. The weekly wine sip, which was out of order today. The kombucha. I'll give you more info on that. And Byron, let's just check people again. Where can we find more information on the festival? We mentioned it, but let's tell everyone the place to go to see if there's tickets for the panels, that dinner, the grand tasting, or the walk-around tasting. Where do we go?
Oh, wildworldfestival.com. Tickets.
Festival with no S.
Festival with no S.
Right.
It's $45 a ticket. We're the cheapest festival. We have no corporate sponsorship. We have the lowest table fee for producers. We're going to have food by Emile from Le Chateaubriand. So please come out and support us.
That's a pretty good offering for the price.
It has to be cheap these days. There's too many festivals.
I guess. And that is October 30th at Strong Rope Brewery in Red Hook, Brooklyn.
Overlooks the bay and the Statue of Liberty. It's a gorgeous setting.
What was the time again?
12 to 6:30.
12 to 6. So don't get there too early because you won't get in. And don't bum yourself out and get there too late. It does sound great. Isn't the dinner up in Hudson?
There's a pop-up dinner with the chef from Chateaubriand after Peripheral, which I encourage people to come to also, on Saturday. It's at Rivertown Lodge. It's $95 a person, which is a bargain.
Which is a bargain.
And you can get tickets. Also go to the website or go to Resy for tickets for that night at Rivertown Lodge.
Okay. All right.
And the dinner. There's a few tickets left for October 29th at the Red Hook Brewery with Dr. Patrick McGovern, Alice Byring, and Garrett Oliver.
You mentioned that.
And,
right?
Yeah,
okay. That's with wine and food. No, I'm happy to mention
it
again.
Yeah, go to that
so there's
on the website
Hudson
also.
Valley and here at Strong Rope.
Yes.
Here is Alice, Garrett, and Dr.
Pat McGovern.
Okay. And there's wine and food.
There's wine and food, and we're going to get really geeky.
And like you said, reservations, tickets still available for everything?
There's a few general public tickets for that.
Okay. So get off your behind if you want to do this, because if you wait, they won't be there. All right, Byron, I want to thank our guest, Byron Bates, for coming in and talking about everything natural wine, his festivals. As always, thank you to our engineer Armin and everyone at the Heritage Radio Network. I'm Sam Benruby, and you've been listening to The Grape Nation. The Grape Nation is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.